Hey, Derek here. Want to know what this week's episode of Motherfuck Lore is about? Here's a little clue from Patter.
The Erotic Misadventures of Derek O'Shea, take one. His left hand turned her head up toward his, then his mouth swooped down on hers. This time, he did not hold back. His lips and tongue against her mouth showed her exactly how far her game playing had pushed him. Rosaline felt dizzy as the fire of his passionate kiss consumed her, and she admitted it. She wanted to burn, to feel him. Her tongue met his intimate embrace. She felt him caress one of her nipples through her thin gown. His fingers made circles, outlining it until it became a hard pebble against his hand. She moaned, her own intense nature rushing to the surface. He made her experience such a fierce wanting. Her hands came out to run along his arms as she pushed herself closer to him, needing more of him, yet not understanding exactly how she could get it. When she felt his hand reach under her skirts to caress the insides of her stocking-clad thighs, a raw shiver of desire coursed through her body. "Oh, Rosaline, I ache for you." He took the soft skin of her ear between his teeth and gave it an erotic bite. "You make me want to nibble every delectable inch of you." "Yes, oh yes, Lucien, I want this too, but..." She glanced over his shoulder. "Should you not lock the door first?"
From the Headstuff Podcast Network, welcome to Motherfuck Lore, Last Orders, podcast about words, Irish, Irish words, and words from Ireland. I am Derek O'Shea. I'm joined again by a former guest, a guest who is on one of our most popular episodes ever. In fact, one of the episodes, and it was so good that right after, there was a pandemic or something. Unfortunately.
The world had heard enough of my voice, and they just hibernated now for the last year and a half.
Welcome back to Motherfuck Lore, Folger Arash, Roisin McNally.
Thank you for having me back, Gormagot.
We are so delighted to have you back. We had so much fun last time talking about TikTok and certain points of Irish mythology and the Skellig lists and all these things. It was great crack. But today we're talking something else. Since things have closed up, this is also TikTok related as well, because there's been one of the hashtags and that's been very big during the pandemic has been book talk.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I myself have gotten roped into it quite often. Okay. I accidentally got a little book talk famous purely by accident.
Oh.
Because of the fancy doodah I have that's somewhere in my room that I will not find due to technical difficulties. But a book embosser. I showed people a book embosser and I woke up the next day and I had like 20,000 likes. Wow. So for a day, I was book talk famous, and then I went right back into my little hole for Irish mythology.
Good stuff. And what is a book embosser?
It's like, you know, when you're in a library and I'll usually have like the pages slightly raised. I think I possibly have one book here with it on. Mm. My favorite, genuine one of my favorite books.
Oh.
It's called, ASMR. Well, maybe I don't.
They'll love that.
Maybe I don't have it, but it basically has my name on it, sitting in the library of Roisin McNally, and it raised up on the page slightly.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so it means then when I lend a book to someone, they have to give it back.
There's a thing now where you lend someone a book, you take a photograph of them holding it.
I should have done that.
And you send it to them. No, it's shocking because people, what really gets me is if you lend someone a book, and you've lent me this book, which we'll talk about shortly, if when you lend someone a book, and if they don't like it, they're less likely to give it back because it's on their bookshelf. Oh, I might finish it. They're not going to finish it.
I would have thought the opposite.
But if someone says, look, I read 10 pages of this book. I'm just not into it. And it's like, I lent it to you. Give it a chance. You know, it's you're making a comment on my book taste by giving a book back after, you know, reading two pages. Yep, not going to do this one.
Does that mean you're not giving my book back, or are you actually going to send it back?
I am sending it back. You could have your address on the back, and thank you so much. So, one of the things in book talk as I mentioned, is that there's been a spike in romance novels. I mean, romance novels have been consistently popular for as long as novels have been published. And there's a theory that one of the reasons that the rail network is so bad in Ireland is that certain elements in the church were worried that people bought certain kinds of books in train stations.
That's really funny too, because most books, like your Mills and Boons and your Harlequins and your Heartfires, most of them are actually published to be sold in places of transit. So you're talking train stations, airports, newsagents, because they're very small books that you'd read on a journey. Of course, the most famous person we all know who reads romance novels on trains being Catherine from Cockamillish. So she's the true fall of the Irish Railway.
And very much so. It is. I mean, yeah, she has a small amount of time to read her book, and you know, she's not interested in being interrupted with small talk, chat. You know, she wants to find out, you know, if raven-haired Claudia does end up with a barrel-chested Hans.
She never does. That's asthmatics. They just keep doing this to us. They keep taking our precious time away to read our romance novels.
And this is the thing. There's like a lot of, obviously, the rail network was destroyed during the War of Independence and the Civil War, particularly in around your part of the country. And when people thought we're talking about rebuilding, it's like, well, what kind of bookshops are they going to be in this train station? I mean, why don't we just have small little train stations? And, you know, what kind of carry on goes on in these places? And, you know, it's small mindedness. But it's interesting that romance novels were a part of that discussion in John Charles McQuaid's own letters. It's really, you can see it right there. But anyway, so this is the romance novels. Several romance novels have really spiked. There was an interest when Kindles first became a thing. Two books started doing very well. One of which was the 50 Shades of Grey series, and the idea is that people felt they're happy, comfortable reading these in trains and stuff without people seeing the outside of the book. Weirdly, one of the other Kindle hits was Mein Kampf.
Oh God!
Yeah,
two very different ends of the spectrum.
People are saying, "Well, why was Mein Kampf doing so well?" I was like, "Oh, it's Kindles."
I suppose it's the same sort of thing. It's not one of those books you want to be caught reading out in public.
Yeah, very much so.
50 Shades of Grey, Nazi propaganda.
Very much, yeah. I think, if people realise that it could be Nazi propaganda, people say, yeah, you absolutely should just be reading smut instead. So there's a few interesting things. We've talked before on this podcast about how Ireland and Irishness is represented in computer games, in fantasy literature and role-playing, in the romantic comedies, and it's in certain other formats. And I wanted to talk about this idea of how Ireland is represented in the world of romance novels. And you very kindly brought a huge amount of expertise to bear on the subject matter, which I'm looking forward to prying from now. So, first of all, maybe there's a lot of people who say that there's a distinction between what the classic romance novel versus what is sometimes called women's literature or chick lit or things like that. I'm not sure if you like or dislike the term chick lit, but it is out there.
I find that so funny. Like, I call this, my family will come in and they're like, "What's that in your shelves?" I go, "Oh, I'm just adding to my erotica collection." Keeps them out of my room. Chicklet, bodice ripper, there's so many names to them. Women's books is obviously a great stereotype to them too. But yeah, chicklet's funny. I like chicklet. The funnier the name, the better, I think.
Yeah, I guess it's one of these things. But if you were going to say, come up with a definition of what it is, romance novel, you know, particularly, or as you would say, from your literary erotica collection, what are the defining characteristics? Is it the size? Is it that the subject matter? Is it certain, or is it that there's certain series? Or
I genuinely think that it's really determined to just the plot points in it as well. Obviously, you have your atypical sort of oil painting covers for your chicklets. But I think it's categorized more so by just the plots of these books. Like, you'll always tell on the back, because it'll always have two paragraphs. First, in the point of view of the female lead, and the second, in the point of view of the male lead. And I think that's a good giveaway to these sort of romance books.
Yeah. That's a very good point, because so this the book, one of the books we're going to be talking about, and you've mentioned this a few others, Midnight Heat by Mary Burkhart.
Yes. Oh my God, I love this book. I've read all of Mary Burkhart books, and every single one of them, absolutely insane.
So if you want to read the female perspective, and I'll read the male perspective from the back cover.
Oh, yes. I feel a particular kinship because myself and the main character have a very similar name, but very different people, very similar name. That's my narcissism coming out. So, Moonlit Ride. Outraged by the poverty and injustice she saw all around her, lovely Rosaline O'Rahilly rode out every night to rob any Englishman foolish enough to travel the roads of Irish Kinsale after dusk. The brave beauty wanted nothing more to do with the English landlords until the evening she met the handsome Duke of Montrose. The fire of promise in his dark eyes and that mastery in his strong, lean hands filled her with the heat she yearned to satisfy, even if it meant risking her freedom.
And from the Duke's perspective, unmasked desire. Lucien sensed danger in the road ahead as his carriage was approached by a caped figure on horseback. But one glimpse of this mysterious highwayman revealed a tantalizing surprise. She had the creamy skin and soft curves of a beautiful woman. He vowed to repay this alluring thief with a tender of his own, a few kisses, slow seduction, whatever it might take to uncover her identity and discover the womanly secrets her heavenly body promised to deliver. Oh man, that's gold.
And it's funny, because when you read the book, he only ever engages with the masked vigilante, I think, is it once or twice, and then becomes completely obsessed with a woman that he doesn't have any association, he thinks at least, to the masked highwayman. So I find the back to be a bit misleading, but also pinnacle in why I choose my books. Also because of the covers.
Very much so. This cover has a fella like who's like a badly made shirt.
Yeah.
Made shirt, ripped out, and he seems to whispering something in a young one's ear, and she's either asleep or having the crack.
She's unconscious. He's pulling her out of what looks like a pond.
Yes, that's right. She is in a pond. And then if you look in the background, it's at the thatched cottage. And a lot of greenery suggests we might be in Ireland.
Possibly. That's a huge factor in these books. Whenever there's any talk of Ireland, there's always going to be the mention of the colour green constantly. I recently just finished today a book called Irish Linen, and she's given a cloak that's green. And I think I may be able to pull up the specific quote on the green cloak.
Excellent.
But it was heavy and well made, with a hood, a shade green darker than the rolling hills of her homeland. Like, it's never just green, it's Irish green.
Of course. I mean, yeah, like, so waking up after a few pints, you know, her face is as green as Ireland or something, but it's always has to be tied into nationality some way. So you've read a lot of romance novels, and I mean, what I was thinking is that are romance novels set in Ireland generally set in a specific point in history? I mean, are we looking at, you know, the arms crisis, or possibly, you know, 1904 Bloomsday type series? Or are we looking at something, a very specific point in history that is the most romantic?
Well, I will say that there are definitely books like that exist that are based in, such as the arms crisis, 1916, maybe even the Troubles. Look at Friends Across the Barricades. I don't read those ones because I only read trash. but I find that I only read historical fiction and sci-fi fiction, because for some reason, anything based in the modern day, I find a little bit too unrealistic. But they all do always tend to be based in the 18th or 19th century. The 18th century, with a huge amount of plantations in Ireland at the time, and with a lot more English landowners. And the 19th century, with the only event that really we think about when it comes to 19th century Ireland, and that is the Great Hunger on Gorta Mór. But that's only when there's a main character, an Irish main character in these books. Whenever an Irish character does exist as a side character, they're 9 times out of 10 going to be in the New World or the colonies, and they come in 3 types if they're not a main character.
Okay.
So the 3 types are the chatty and clever Irish servant girl.
Oh, yes.
So a lot of that has more relations to you know, a lot of young Irish girls were immigrated over to the US and Canada, I believe. And I found this out recently. A lot of workhouses were set up with schemes that would send a lot of teenage girls from 14 to 18 to become domestic workers in Canada and such. And so obviously they're always going to play a very vital role as the servant girl. The other is the young, boisterous Irish lads, and they always come in groups. There's never just one of them. They're always usually in groups of two or three. And they've come from the Ireland to find riches in the new world, and they do hard work and they never complain, and they're always great crack to be around, but they don't get romantic interests because they're young, sort of whippet, scrappy wee lads. And then the third, of course, being our favourite stereotype, the drunk man down at the pub.
Oh yes, so three fine characters to be having right.
Yeah, in Ireland you cut the three genders. There is servant girl, witty man, drunk.
God, that's shocking. That's it's I suppose this is interesting. You think that there's certain nationalities fit certain characteristics in the storytelling, and often one of the things for me that about romance novels, I think about this now when say a certain writer every year, oh, there's a new book by this writer coming out, whereas often romance novelists have a high output. There's, in fact, in looking at Ireland, there's a writer in Ballymena called Lynn Graham, who has written over a 30-year period 100 novels for Mills and Boon.
God, that's actually amazing. It's like that's a book every 4 months. What else is there to do in Ballymena? But.
Well, yeah, sure. Yeah, it's, but Balbal, I mean, is a beautiful part of the country, you know, and I suppose it's it is, but it's I just find it very interesting, the idea that I just think like how long it takes to write one book, and then it's impressive output to have to be able to produce that much popular stuff.
Yeah, and I've never read her books, but I find that romance novels, they're such fun reads. So you can imagine she probably had a lot of fun writing them out, that she didn't really, not exactly need a break, but she could fire it out so quickly because these books are so fun. And just imagining now that, you know, your most romance novels are based in London or New York or the romance capital of Ireland, Ballymena.
Yeah, absolutely. It is funny that is Ballymena the most romantic town in Ireland now? It has a claim.
Yeah, it was either that or Dingle from Leap Year.
Oh yes,
when they all landed in Dingle.
Famously, that's where you go when you've been diverted from Wales.
Yeah,
everyone knows. But it's Roisin, when did you get into romance novels?
Well, do you know what? I was only thinking of this the last day, and I was like, oh, it probably happened when I lived in Australia. But the reality is, it was when I read Twilight. Like most teenage girls, Twilight was most people's introduction to romance novels. And Twilight's a perfect example of gothic literature. And I kind of stopped reading for a while. And then I moved to Australia with my sister in 2019. And I wanted to read something, but I didn't want to read anything I could be too committed to that I would have to bring back to Ireland. And there was secondhand bookshop near where I lived, and I went into this little room to the back of it, and I wish I was joking, it was floor to ceiling, all the entire room romance novels. So I picked three of the worst covers I could find, and of those books I still only have the one that is now sellotaped together with an old Starbucks bag because it was falling apart, and the others are who knows where. I think I left a note in one of them being like, this is a terrible read, please enjoy. But they were such fun books to read because I didn't have to think when I was reading them. I could just sit down, read it, enjoy it, put it down, never think of it again. And at the start of COVID, and I remember it was December time in COVID, and I suggested to my friends that for Christmas we do this thing, and we've been doing it every year since, called Merry Romancemas or Triple Xmas, where we find each other the worst romance novels we can find and then send each other like a Secret Santa thing.
That's a great idea.
So I was looking for books, and I brought my friend Neil to Universal Books in Letterkenny, and it's all great secondhand books and stuff. And I found this one called Highland Ecstasy, and I bought it for him, and I said to him, you read this? And he's like, God, no. And I took it home and I read it, and I became absolutely obsessed. I read it in a day, and the next day I was like, okay, I need to find more of these books.
Highland Ecstasy.
Highland Ecstasy.
Tell me a little bit about Highland Ecstasy.
Highland Blind Ecstasy is about a woman who inherits a castle in Scotland that is apparently haunted by the old lord, the previous owner who killed himself as vengeance against the English. Turns out, didn't kill himself. He's pretending to be a ghost in the castle to try scare her out. Her name is Myrtle. Myrtle's not having any of it. He wants her out because she's English. And one of these books, you'll find, if there's a main character that is not English, they're usually going to reject their nationality towards the end. It's amazing. But
oh my god, that's if the fiery heroine isn't actually from England, she will find a way to become English.
Or no, vice versa. So the fiery heroine is English, but she falls in love with... The best examples are, like, the book you read. The Duke of Montrose basically rejects his Englishness. He much prefers Ireland. Other books I've read with a lot of Native Americans, the women reject their previous white heritage to join these Native American tribes and embrace them more so. And with these ones that are based in Scotland, they usually reject the English tyranny that has ravaged the lands of Scotland and tend to side with their Scottish counterparts. Those are just some examples. And there's this interesting theme of kind of rejection of identity. And like, for some cases, and it's a horrible way to phrase it, it's like rejecting what's considered civilized culture for one that's a lot more endearing and one that's a lot more open and embraces them a lot more. You see that with Myrtle. You see that with Rosaline in Midnight Heat. And you see it in the previous book. I just have a stack of them sitting here. That's actually about Rosaline's mother, who's English, and her father, who Taggart, his name is. And Taggart O'Rahilly, who's Irish, and she decides that actually I much prefer Ireland and to be with my Irish husband.
Can you show me that book again? Because it looks like it's Marty Morrissey who's kissing that girl on the neck. Oh my god, it is.
Yeah, Marty Morrissey makes a couple of covers here. I also have I knocked a whole stack over of them earlier on my floor. Where do you go? Oh no, I have them here. I have Freddie Mercury too, in front of this one.
God, you're not joking. Yeah, the moustache, and Jessica Wolfe wrote that one. And he's basically just wearing a jeans without a shirt, and she's wearing a kind of a Morticia Adams kind of red nighty.
And what you can't see is that it's the only cover I have. This is my least favourite cover, but it's the only cover that has like a shiny metallic cover on it.
Oh yeah, it does. Very swish.
To reflect the blue skies of either Ireland or Wyoming. I haven't read this one yet, so I'll find out. But Highland Ecstasy's plot. I just love the plot. I have to go back to it because it's just so insane. So she thinks the place is haunted. She doesn't care. She wants to do the castle up and help the clan, which is Ian Sinclair. And he finds out that she's reading his diary and his raunchy pirate novels from his private library. So he sneaks into her room to try and get them back, and he's caught wearing this, what can only be described as a Phantom of the Opera getup. He's got a powdered wig on, a mask, but he's also described as being like 6'2" and built like a brick wall. So she's in the bath, she starts screaming. He then has to pretend, they call him Eurisk, and the Angus, who's like the maintenance man of the building, is like, oh, that's just Eurisk. He's not all there. He was beaten up as a child by English soldiers. So that's why he has the mind of a young boy. So she then thinks that this giant man is just a bit slow. And that goes on for a couple of chapters until I think there's murder attempt on her life number two or three. I can't remember. And he's so enraged by this another murder attempt that he picks her up and he's cursing in Latin and Gaelic and English and French, and he throws her into her room. And then she's like, someone who's not all there doesn't speak perfect Latin or French or Gaelic. What's going on here? And then Angus has to come in and be like, he's had brain leaks, he's back to normal. And then for the rest of the book, he just has to pretend to keep wearing the mask due to pox scars so he won't recognize her, until I think people, I'm going to spoil the entire book, I'll stop there, but it is the wildest book I've read in my life. And I actually had to buy two copies of it because my original copy is falling apart and has all these sticky tabs in it that I've marked for sexy scenes, quote unquote, bizarre moments and murder attempts. So I think there's about four or five murder attempts in this book, but it is wild.
The copy you lent me had like orange tags for sexy scenes, green tags for bits of Irish language, blue tags for kind of exciting kind of dialogue. And it was interesting to see, that someone, I'm not sure how, if Mary Burkhart spent a lot of time in Ireland before writing this or how much research was involved, but she used the glocha, cutie, as a term of endearment.
Yeah, I saw that. That happens a lot in the previous book as well. And I was like, I don't think I've ever heard that as a term of endearment.
No, I've heard people describing babies as glocha, but maybe I haven't. But in terms of saying glocha as a noun,
yeah,
you know, or a proper noun, even in fact.
She probably had an English-Irish dictionary in front of her and just flicked through like a word for darling. Oh, that'll do. But it's funny because even though a lot of these books, whenever there is a main protagonist, there's no Irish ever spoken in them. Like, and I find that really unrealistic. Not that these books are, but for example, I just finished reading Irish Linen, and it begins in the year 1847 on a coffin ship on its way to Philadelphia, while a girl named Megan McBride watches her father be thrown overboard because he died in the most Irish way possible. And throughout the book, the only time there's ever mentions of any Irish, it's not between the girl having a conversation with other Irish people on the ship, because let's face it, a lot of people going over from Ireland to America would have only spoken Irish.
Yeah.
But there's no mention of that anywhere. There's also no mention of any names with traditional Irish spellings. Like there's a Bridget and a Mary and, you know, your typical sort of Irish names, but you'd never find like a Fionnuala or a Donoghue or a Diarmaid. You'd always just find like your Marys, your Bridgets, your Seans and your Johns, or Rafferty. That's the name of the villain in this. But
Irish. His name's Rafferty.
A lot of surnames as first names, I've noticed in these books.
Yeah, that's an interesting American tradition. I think it's an American tradition borrowed from Scotland, I'm told.
Yeah, and again, the only time the only Irish word mentioned in this entire book is Sassany.
Of course, that's one that gets a lot of attention now because it's been made very popular by Outlander.
Oh yeah.
And I'm not sure if Outlander would be fully. I think Outlander would be more historical novel rather than romance novel, even though it has significant romance elements.
I don't know. I've never actually read it, but I have seen a few episodes, and I would classify it as a romance novel just because it's such a prevalent theme in the books that it has to be considered then. It's a bit like I have the novelization of The Mummy in front of me, and I think it reads. The movie's not a romance novel, and it is my favorite movie of all time, but the book, the novelization by Max Allan Collins, it reads like a romance novel. So I would categorize this as a romance novel.
The novelization of The Mummy.
Yeah.
one of the best books? I mean, yes, we know The Mummy is a wonderful film.
It's incredible. I have my little Funko Pops here of Rick O'Connell and Evie Carahan, whatever her name is. But I would never classify that as a romance film, but I'd classify the novelization as a romance novel because it really reads like one.
The idea of a novelization of a screenplay actually switching genres shows a certain amount of literary daring.
And it's hard to do. Like, it's not a great book, but it's all right. And that was very popular a few years ago. You'd always see in the young adult section, there'd be like the novelization of a recent show, or you used to get the novelization of live action Disney movies. That was very popular for children. But I think it's much harder to do for adult literature because adults are a lot more critical of comparing one media to another. It's like vice versa when you have a book turned into a film. Like, they're two very different types of media.
Yeah. No, I remember just even broaching the topic of me doing a novelization of Fatal Deviation and just the kind of the criticism that Scott looked like this wasn't a worthwhile project to be doing. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
But I think the idea, I mean, we accept that, yes, that we accept that the plays can become films can become musicals, books can become films and stage plays and all these go all the way around. But somehow, yes, it seems to be that a text can go down the chain in adaptations, but it can't go up the chain. So you can't make an epic poem based on, you can't make an opera based on a novel because opera is above novels.
Yeah.
Fad Camp is a comedy podcast about the ridiculousness of fad diets and diet culture, hosted by me, Grace Mulvey.
And me, Connor Dowling. If you have a body of any kind, chances are you've crossed paths with at least one of the bizarre diet trends we cover in our show.
And between me and Connor, we have done nearly every fad diet there is.
Juice cleansing.
Fasting.
The potato diet.
Which is actually a real diet, by the way, and we don't recommend it.
So join us as we try to make sense of the madness that is diet culture.
Find Fad Camp everywhere you get your podcasts and make sure to follow us on Instagram and Twitter at Fad Camp Podcast.
So, Russian, when we think about romance novels, there's often kidnapping and, you know, and confrontational situations between lovers and things like that. And how does it all fit in with modern values and, you know, all that? Is kidnapping romantic?
Oh, no. Absolutely not. But in a book, I saw this girl on Twitter, on TikTok, her name's at Virgo Reader, and she goes, "What's something you love in a romance novel and hate in real life?" And people had really good points. My favorite would be usually men. But people some people are like, "I love the idea of someone being very confrontational and hating it if somebody else might touch the person they're interested in and get into a physical fight over it." And they love that in a romance novel. If someone tried that in real life, I would just leave. Mm-hmm. And I think it's just the way it's portrayed when it's written by a woman, it's a lot more ideal because it's kind of written in a very romantic way. But when you see that in real life, it's usually between two men. And you're like, "I'm not into this. I'm going to leave." Block on Facebook. But you see a lot of that in these books. You see these sort of absolutely insane plot points that you're like, "How the hell is this romantic?" But then you read it and you're like, "Oh, I kind of get it. Don't want it happening to me, but I kind of get it." Like, I have one in front of me about a Viking who purchases a slave from Egypt. I have another one about a woman sold into the slave trade in China in the early 20th century, and she's known as the White Lotus. Not romantic at all. And there's so much arranged marriage ones as well. Does not work. But in a book,
and this is the thing, arranged marriages, and I'm thinking one of the big breakthroughs in book talk was a science fiction romance where barbarians were on an ice planet.
Ice Planet Barbarians by Ruby Dixon. You mean the literary masterpiece I've read four books of?
Four out of a series of 22. And obviously, the serious subject matter needs 22 books to be fully, you know, explored. But basically, it seems there's an intergalactic sex trafficking ring or something.
So what happens is these women, it begins with Georgie, and you can't see this, but when I talk with my hands, I'm getting into it. So it begins with Georgie. Georgie's kidnapped by aliens and she's brought into a chamber prison with a load of other women. They're all 22. They're all fit. They're all healthy looking. But six girls are already in pods and they're basically picking up extra cargo as they go along. So they're stuck in this alien bay. And I will say the books aren't for... There are mentions of SA and a lot of very traumatic themes in these books. So in the first one, I would skip and then maybe start in the second. But basically, they are about to crash. So the aliens leave their cargo on this ice planet they call Not Hoth because it's all covered in snow. Much like, I don't know, I've never seen Star Wars. It's Not Hoth.
Okay, so Not Hoth.
Yeah, like the Hoth, like the planet in Star Wars. One of them goes out looking for food or civilization and she comes across a giant blue man who's about 6 foot something, blue, rippling muscles, horns, and purring. And the whole point of the book is that these women get rescued by these ice planet barbarians because they're basically buff blue Neanderthals. They're like if the characters in Avatar went to the gym 6 days a week or were being cast in Love Island the next season. So they're all incredibly buff and they all need mates. And it just so happens there's enough females they can mate with that will suit all of the straight males or the single males, within the tribe. And 22 books in the series, they are insane. They shouldn't work, but they do. And I've read four of them. They can be incredibly graphic, though, and it'll just come out of nowhere. And it's like reading I've never really actually compared it to, because suddenly they'll be going for like a walk through the woods and decide, ah, here's the perfect place to do the horizontal monster mash. Let's write 6 pages of that and then continue on as normal. And it is, it is the weirdest book. But Book Talk, as in, well, a girl named Emma, she started off doing the TikTok on it. And if you go look it up now, it has hundreds of thousands of likes collectively. And the books themselves are only €3 each. There's 22 books in a series. So Ruby Dixon has sold, I don't know how many copies she sold. I have looked. But if you base that just on engagements on TikTok and just how cheap the books actually are.
Yeah.
Like and they were published in 2016. She's probably made millions since then. All because some girl on TikTok was like, this is a really weird book I read, but I loved it. And you should read it too.
This is the funny thing. And I think that it's... I was listening to the In Case You Missed It or podcast up through Slate, and they were discussing the idea of Book Talk, and they compared how the Song of Achilles got a certain bump from winning the Orange Prize a few years ago, but the commercial bump in sales it got from Book Talk was significantly higher, and that actually Book Talk is something that bookshops have to actually find a way to incorporate or predict or work around, because this is actually, it seems to be the format, social media format most suited to actually getting book recommendations out.
Oh, absolutely. Like from what I see, a lot of people recommend books in a group. So like if you like Enemy to Lovers, here are some great books you could read. If you like Friends to Lovers to Enemies, here's some other books you could read. If you like Fate, if you like mythology, they categorize them. And I think because most, up until a few weeks ago, you could only film up to a minute. And I think that's enough for recommending books, because people don't want to be having a 10-minute spiel on why you should read a book. It should just be like, here's a really good book. This is what it's about. You should give it a read. And that's all people need. And like, I've seen shops across the states are setting up tables being like popular book talk books. And books like books by Sarah J. Maas and Madeline Miller, like you mentioned, and Ruby Dixon and Julia Quinn, especially since Bridgerton came out, have become hugely popular thanks to Book Talk.
You know, earlier on this year, Garagine and I actually discussed romance novels, specifically the series Bridgerton. Here's a little clip of the record for supporters and Patreon. So, Garagine, did you watch Bridgerton?
Did I watch? Yes, I did. And I thoroughly enjoyed it. I enjoyed it so much. Not so much for the plot, much like a lot of people didn't enjoy it for the plot. But it was great crack. I enjoyed the costuming. I enjoyed the ridiculousness. I enjoyed the writing. It was great. I had a fun time watching it.
It was a fierce, fierce randy show altogether.
I know, like there comes a point where you're like, I hope nobody comes into the room in the middle of this, because I mean, it's porn on the telly. And my boyfriend was not in the room with me. He was in the playing video games. And I just kind of like yelled in at him. And I was like, I'm not watching porn, just so you know. And he was like, what? And I was like, not that there's anything wrong because I'm sex positive, but I'm not watching porn. It's Netflix. But yeah, I watched it. And it seems to me that so did everybody else, because it's like Netflix's most popular show or something of that description.
It's the funny thing, and obviously it dropped at Christmas time, and a lot of people, typically, the reason people watch films at Christmas isn't because Christmas is inherently cinematic. It's just that back in the old days in TV stations, they gave everyone the day off, and they just taped a bunch of old films on so that they wouldn't have to have people on. So, whereas, but now, I think now that people have a different relationship to television, Netflix are obviously seeing this as a way to launch a brand new show, and it got a lot of interest. But one of the things is, yes, Bridgerton is based on a series of romance novels, and the first one from a series. But then it's historical, and it's historical to a point, and it's set in a Jane Austen-y world, Restoration-y world, and it raises a number of issues in that some there are modern sensibilities in some aspects and not in others. And some people say, have Shonda and the author and all the other people involved, have they decided, yes, let's be in a world where racism is mostly resolved, but not the other stuff, so we can still choose to fight yesterday's battles in some social issues, but not in others?
Yeah, and I've seen those debates happening, like particularly around, like the racism seems to be somewhat gone. They acknowledge it in like one episode, sort of vaguely, and then the misogyny is not gone. The gender roles aren't gone, you know. whatever, I don't care. And maybe that's coming from a perception of our point of privilege, but like, I'm not watching it for social commentary. That's for sure. I'm watching it because it was quite rightly described to me as Gossip Girl, but make it Jane Austen. And like, sign me the fuck up, because the first episode, in the first maybe 10 minutes, they have a string quartet version of Thank You Next. And I was like, where does this need to go into my veins? That's where. This is great. I love this. This is excellent television. I loved it so much. It was wonderful. And like, I think it is, it's good to have, like, because like, if you're to be like historically accurate, you know, you cut a whole cohort of people out of a possibility to like cast them, right? If you're just going to be talking about boring, white, stuffy people in Mayfair, then you can only have the boring, white, stuffy people. And let me tell you, there was a lot of those people. But like, there wasn't just those people. And you know, it was a lot of fun. It was a great show. I did find that if we were to take social commentary of it, it's that the necessity for sex education for women has never been more pertinent than in Bridgerton.
Yes.
Yeah. The ladies of Mayfair need adequate sex positive sex sex education.
And so, I hope they get that. More comfortable supporting garments. God, they look really uncomfortable.
No, hey, listen, as a woman who's very into sewing and creating garments, let me tell you, the only uncomfortable corset is a poorly made corset, okay? So all of these like images of corsets where they're like really uncomfortable, that's some BS. If you get a well-made corset, that shouldn't be uncomfortable. Otherwise, it doesn't fit you properly. Waist training corsets, I don't want to talk about those, okay? I have a lot of feelings about those. This took a turn, didn't it? But if they're uncomfortable, it's because they don't fit properly. I appreciate that the ones in Bridgerton were very much like the goal was to be able to rest a cereal bowl on your cleavage, which, listen, if you can do that, that sounds like a fun time. But maybe that's not fully how, I don't know, maybe that's not fully how it happened. I don't know.
And that was me encouraging doing the Patreon bonus content, which all of those our bonus episodes will be available to Headstuff Plus subscribers after Motherfucker wraps up. So please do consider supporting a wonderful podcast network. I meant to mention Bridgerton because that seemed to have changed the conversation a little bit about romance novels, in that I suppose like last Christmas when they just dropped all that Bridgerton and people, there was a huge amount of interest, but then there was a level of analysis which maybe the text wasn't actually asking for.
Oh yeah.
I mean, the idea is, yes, they've maybe because generally speaking a romance novel series hasn't been given the idea that the Shonda Rhimes treatment before, you know, someone who has been associated with, you know, as well as kind of gloriously entertaining ridiculous shows, but also things, shows that have dealt with, you know, issues like representation and on serious topics as well. So it's the idea that suddenly people are saying, well, what are the ethics of, you know, colorblind casting, and what are the issues here, and why are you taking a modern position on this topic but not that topic? And it's missing what the actual story was really about, which was about doing sex.
Yeah. Like, just all it needs has been a romance, but it has far too much critical thinking on what is essentially just, I'm not going to say a nice romantic story due to some of the themes that we see in the first series of Bridgerton, but it's too much thinking on just an interesting outlook, another interesting structure of a romance novel. And especially then we see the same sort of backlash that you might get for like the casting of The Little Mermaid. They've recently cast Halle Berry, not your one from Monsters. It's a young singer, and she's just a black woman. And there's a huge amount of backlash for that because Ariel's not a black girl. Ariel's a white girl. But again, it's all fiction. And Ariel's a fish.
A Danish fish.
A Danish fish. And I think people are just getting slightly too emotionally involved when it comes to romance novels, because things that are written in books, like we mentioned earlier, they're not going to be the exact same on television. So there's nothing wrong with having a bit of blind colour casting with these sort of novels. And it doesn't deserve the sort of critical thinking people thinks it does, because it's just a story. It doesn't really matter who should be playing who, because when you're reading it on the book as well, unless they state otherwise, you're not going to know what they look like. That's a whole different tangent.
It is the thing, and we know that, like, that often with great films have made significant changes to the books they've been adapted from. They've cut out entire, you know, chapters, and they've, you know, jettisoned characters that no one was interested in. So it's all part of the thing. Is there a romance novel series you think would be suitable for another Netflix production?
I'm just saying, Highland Ecstasy, absolutely perfection. But do you know, there's actually one book series, and I was only thinking this purely because of how popular Gossip Girl was. Gossip Girl was adapted from books. So Gossip Girl series was adapted from books. So was the Vampire Diaries, but they were from books. Most of the most popular teen series are come from what is essentially, 9 times out of 10, a romance novel directed at young girls. And if I could have any romance novel sort of series turn into TV show, I'd choose The Lux by Anna Godbrisson. It's not very popular. It's basically Gossip Girl in the year 1899, high society in New York.
Oh.
And if I could have any series put into this big screen, it would be that. It's got very, very much Bridgerton vibes.
That's I think a lot of people who are listening will definitely want to look up that. Yeah. So you mentioned there before that, say, a fiery English heroine or American heroine falls in love and finds a community which would ordinarily be using a minority language.
Yeah.
And how either these minority languages are not represented at all or sprinkled in from your own knowledge of Irish. And so you may have noticed, say, that, as we said, in Midnight Heat, a handful of Irish words just used for flavoring. And is this just a general pattern? Is this something that could be done better, should be done better, would actually improve the books if it was done better? Would
I think yes and no, because the find that if I think a lot more thought should be going into things like when it comes to, I'll say Irish romances as an example, because if you put more thought into it, there's going to be a lot more heart into it. There's going to be a lot more engagement with other readers. But also, things like these are not written to be, they're not written to win prizes. So I think they get a pass sometimes. Yeah.
Just so for our listeners, things like this, when Roisin was saying that, she's holding up a copy of Irish Linen by...
It's by Candace McCarthy. She has a little note at the back as well. And I thought, I'll read the note to you, because I actually thought it was so interesting that she included this as an author's note. And with a name like McCarthy, I'm going to assume she has Irish or Scottish lineage. And the plot of the book is based, like I said, during the famine. An Irish girl moves to New York. Not New York. She moves to Delaware to meet her engaged husband, who's a friend of her father. Getting jumbled now. But she wrote, most of the Irish immigrants who came to America during the Great Famine entered the States in New York or Boston. Only a fortunate few managed to arrive directly in Philadelphia. The Irish in Philadelphia were the lucky ones, for their opportunities for employment and were greater. While many households were advertised they wanted to hire Protestants only, it was the fact that Catholic Irish women were in demand as domestics. But life of the Irish immigrant was different in New York and other cities, where they faced prejudiced shop windows and other signs of employment holding signs saying Nina, no Irish need apply. And then it also, I won't go read the whole thing, but then it compares how the female lead, Megan, her life in America is much more positive than the male antagonist, Rafferty, because they both have very different experiences when they arrive. And it's mostly due to their age, and it's also due to how they engage in the community around them. And I thought that was really interesting for her to throw in, because, like, you read it as a bit of smut, really. And then you get to these notes and you realise, like, they do put a lot of thinking into this. And these books, as they are bodice rippers, but there's a lot of heart written into them as well. There's a lot of plot development, character development. There's a lot of very interesting conversations that go on. And 9 times out of 10, the women in them are very self-sufficient. And the men in them love them for that as well. And why I think they get a bad rep because people just associate them with sex books, where really they're books about romance that leads to sex, just a factor in them. And feminist literature, and I'll stand by that, because I think they're so nicely written, most of them, because they're written in the point of view of a woman. And there's a lot of a much softer tone, particularly when it comes to the characters of the men. And while they might be doing things like buying women indentured servitude papers or stopping them from being highwaymen or whatever they're doing, there's a great sense of respect they have for women in these books. But of course, I saw this quote once that the only men I like are men written by women. And I stand by that. But yeah, I find it so interesting because you read them for a light read, and they are a great light read, and they can be so funny because with romance novels, you can make any plot you want around them. Another Mary Burkhart book is about a half Japanese ninja and a psychosomatic paraplegic. Try and figure that one out. But there's romance from there.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah.
It's great. It's called The Panther and the Rose. It's my most expensive, most amount of money I've ever spent in a romance novel because I read it and I had to buy it. It cost me €20. No regrets. But they're such fun, light reads, but then there's such depth to them as well, which, not that I'm saying that only a woman can do, but that you can tell a woman did these. That being said, one of a romance novels that I read quite a lot is Lee Greenwood. And I was very surprised to find out that Lee Greenwood, who wrote the Seven Brides books, was a man. And he writes a lot of these sort of cowboy romance novels. And I thought that was so interesting because this book reads so well. It reads like it's a romance novel. There's a lot of respect for the female leads. There's a lot of respect for the male leads towards their female leads. And it's just such an interesting idea that a man wrote this. And I compare that to books by the man, I can't remember his name, the guy that wrote The Last Song and The Notebook. He does romance novels well, but they read very differently, I think, compared to these ones.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. And there is a kind of a recurring trope, particularly on Twitter, of the idea of the female character written by a man, and the idea of, you know, that she wakes up in the morning yawning with her breasts visible underneath her thin nightie as she goes, she breasts boobily down the stairs. And yes, and then when she, of course, yes, it seems like this. For some reason, it's always important to mention what her breasts are like.
That's, you know what? There's a lot of boob talk in this book, particularly. Mm. But it's with great respect, I will say, as a girl with boobs. But that being said, you can always tell these books are written by women. If you read a smut scene and the woman's getting a lot of attention, it's probably written by a woman. And that's something in these books I've noticed. The women get a lot of attention. The men get none.
Oh, as in the descriptions of the activities are centered on female pleasure.
Oh, yeah. Like, it's mostly the men, and there's absolutely no hesitation in it whatsoever. That's their number one priority. Pleasure the woman first. But you wouldn't get that in a lot of books written by a man. I'm just saying, no offense.
Great stuff. And before we wrap up, do you think a person who picked up a book, you know, a romance novel set in Ireland, might actually learn something about Ireland?
I think they'll learn about our disdain for oppressors and those, and I quote, damn Saxons, and hopefully our love for the colour green and the fact that we all either have hair, bright auburn coloured hair, or raven hair. There's no brunettes, no blondes, there's none of that, and we all know how to sing, and we all have lilts in our voice, and we all have fiery tempers, but if a man attempts to kill another man for us, then we're probably going to enjoy that.
Roisin McNally, where can people find your work?
You can find me on TikTok at @roro_the_terrible, so named after my icon, Ivan the Terrible, also because I'm bad at everything. Or you can find me at Twitter at @Roisin_McNally. But before we go, I have a fun list for you, if you like.
Oh,
enjoy.
Yes, of course. I do absolutely do want that.
So as I read these books, I like to collect what I call my APF, or appropriate places to fornicate. So these are places that you are allowed to, according to these books, do the horizontal monster mash wherever you want. And I'll fire through it very quickly. But the first is a Scottish castle. Always good to know.
Oh, yes.
The second is the abandoned childhood home of your father. That is from Midnight Heat. Number three is a meadow. Oh, so romantic. Number four is very specific. It is the top of a Mayan temple, specifically on the block they did the human sacrifices.
Why?
And the quote in the book was, they were offering up their love of us as a sacrifice instead. Oh, it was a weird one. And that was, which one was that? I think that something Midnight or Ecstasy. I can't remember. Number five is a perfect replica of a Japanese washitsu built into an English manor house. Number 6, a merchant ship. Number 7, a pirate ship. No famine ships. For some reason, that's a bit too far.
Yeah, that would be too far, but a pirate ship would be fun.
Pirate ship's fun. That happened in a book where a woman time traveled on the back of a dolphin. From 1988.
If dolphins can time travel, is that where Fungi's gone?
Fungi's gone. He's taken women to pirate ships in the Caribbean in the 18th century. He's away now. Now we have Wally the Walrus. He can't time travel. He can only see into the future and tell us our demise.
Wally is such a rebound. Like, no, it'll never be the same as our beloved dolphin.
R.I.P. R.I.P. Fungi. Someone write a romance novel about him.
Is there anything else on this list?
There's also the back of those old wooden caravans. The 9 is against a hay bale. Really good this time of year. They're baying the hail. 10 is beside a pond. 11, the jungles of Mexico. 12, the jungles of the Congo. 13, a seedy 18th century Mexican inn. 14 and 15 are cabins in the snow and the woods. 16 is a hot springs. 17, along a Native American's wall. A teepee. Libraries. A tent made out of animal pelts. A cottage, and to end, in the spare room of the Duke that wants to turn you into the king's mistress.
You know, I've crossed off maybe 3 of those.
Yeah, this is why I'm not allowed back in the jungles of Mexico myself.
Roisin, thank you so much. That is fantastic. Until the next time, it's a slán from me.
And a slán from me.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of Mother Folklore, and thank you to Roisin McNally for being such a brilliant guest again. Do check her out on TikTok. Mother Folklore will continue to come out on Fridays until we wrap up. Thanks very much to Brian for producing. Thank you very much to Kirsten Scheele for doing our artwork. Thank you to the backroom team at Headstuff for keeping the show going. We record the podcast on remotely.fm. We recommend that if you are thinking of making a podcast yourself, that this is an excellent app to use. We've tried others. This is our favorite one, and you can use the link in our show notes if you want to check that out more. Until the next time, slán go fóill.
This has been a production of the Headstuff Podcast Network.
Well, I suppose what else is there to do in Ballymena?
And let me just conclude by saying, what the fuck did I just read?